Hey there, everyone. Thanks for listening to Limited Engagement. I'm your host for the show, Jared Duran. My guest on this episode is Bree Malloy, and we'll get to that in just a minute. I fucking did it. I got Susu over the new apartment. It was a huge fucking ordeal. She hates the crate, and I hate putting her in it. So we fought with it. And then I was just like, fuck it, and let her run off. And I hate the idea that I might be hurting her in some way. And so I don't like to just shove her in the crate. And it's, you know, anyway, I ended up moving other things throughout the day and just periodically trying to get her in the crate. And, long story short, eventually it happened. But I mean, how do you reason with a cat? How do you convince them that if they could just get in the crate for 10 minutes, it would all be over? But there is no reasoning. Eventually, you know, I don't know. Who knows how much these cats understand, right? Or dogs or your pets. We like to give them much more credit than their brains are built for, really. But, you know, maybe it's being shut in with them as your only companion for what is this, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 3 weeks? Who knows? Time is becoming meaningless. Which, as it's a human construct, you know, it can very quickly do that. But anyway, just kind of sat there with her, told her, look, you're like the only thing left in the old apartment. All your stuff is at the new place. Your food is there, your bed, your tree, all that kind of stuff, your box. You have to go. And she put up a fight still, but not as bad. She ended up going in, complained the entire drive, shit and pissed the cage, whatever, which I was prepared for. Having learned my lesson, I put some pads down. And then I just, you know, after we got here and I let her out into the new place, I just fucking threw that crate out. I'm like, I'm done. I'm not planning to move for a while. I am, you know, barring any unforeseen circumstances, at which point I'll have to get a new crate. And if she needs to go to the vet, I'll have to get a new crate for that. But it's just like that thing has, you know, put the two of us between or through enough trauma. So it was just time for it to go. But we're here. We did it. Now that the move is just about done, I have to go back to the old place and do some cleanup and that kind of thing. But there's a few things that this move has kind of brought to some thoughts that have come out of it. One is that a pandemic is the worst time to move. If you can avoid it, I recommend it. The other is that having moved all of my stuff myself, taken apart furniture so that it would fit in the car, and then put it back together, schlepped it through the parking lot and upstairs and all that, is that I'm, you know, 37 years old, and I get sore a lot more quickly than I used to. I don't know. I don't know. This isolation thing. I'm wondering now that the move is done, or just about done, and that distraction will have gone away, what am I going to do with all this time here by myself? It'll be fine. I'm not too worried about it. I'll be able to get resettled. I can get some more writing done. That would be nice. There's a lot of stuff for Hoot and Waddle that needs to be done still, that I've gotten behind on because of the said move. So I should have some time for all of that stuff, getting all caught up. I don't know. Like I said, we'll see how this goes. It's going to last for the foreseeable future. People are saying that we haven't even hit peak yet as far as people getting infected. Hopefully the... I don't know. The supplies, all of that will be around. I'm entertaining the idea of getting a lot more stuff delivered. I got a call this morning reminding me that my gas is getting turned on tomorrow, which I had forgotten about. I was planning to cook today because I had gotten some groceries and had been eating food that was delivered for the last few days, and it's been a nice treat because I very rarely do that. I would like to get back to making some, stuff that's a little better for me. And then I got that call and I'm like, oh shit, I couldn't, even if I wanted to right now, cook. So hopefully the mushrooms will still be good tomorrow. So I wound up eating cold pizza over the sink because I also, one of the things I need to get moved over here is my dishes. It's like, that's great. COVID-19 or COVID-19 again. That's a terrible, terrible, terrible joke. You're welcome, or I'm sorry. Whatever. So, cat owners talk all the time about, when you move them and the cats, not the owners, when the owners move the cats, it's what I'm talking about, that, they'll be mad at you for a little while. Susu doesn't stay mad. She forgives pretty quickly. So she was all snuggling up next to me last night while I ate pizza when it was still warm and fresh, and watched Quantum Leap, which is a show that I haven't watched since I was a kid, but the box set was on sale a few years ago and I picked it up and it's like, let me watch a show that I used to enjoy. And it still holds up. It's great comfort watching. There's some things. I didn't remember quite how heavy-handed the religious tones are. Not mentioned denomination specifically or anything, but there are a lot of references to God, and I don't think that I paid attention to that as a kid, but that's, like I said, it's pretty heavy-handed. I think that they get out of that as the show goes on. We'll see. Probably haven't watched it in like 25, 30 years. It doesn't matter. I'm not researching that now. But I was at least a teenager the last time I watched it. But I'm enjoying it again. It's fun. Found out my cat is a food snob, which is odd for someone for a cat that eats as much as she does. But yeah, I put out food for her last night, and she didn't really eat it. I think she was still getting reacclimated, and she would not touch it this morning. She would not eat until I got rid of that and put a fresh can out for her. And I'm like, really? You're going to make me waste a can at a time where we have to, like, have your food delivered, you know? But I'm happy to be in the new place. I like this place already so much better than the old place. I might put some pictures up on Instagram. I don't know. Probably not. We'll see. My stuff's always in the background when I'm taking pictures of Susu or something that I post, but it's like pretty ideal for me, this place. And when everything reopens again, it'll be great. But who knows when that'll be. So that's where things are. That's the update. If you want to subscribe to the show, if you haven't already, rate and review it if you haven't done that already. Those things would be great. LTD underscore engagement on Twitter, and then just LTD engagement on Instagram. I really, really rarely do Facebook anymore, so don't even mention it. If you'd like to support the show, it's patreon.com/hootandwaddle. And then to today's guest, who I had been wanting to talk to since I read her column for the Phoenix New Times, which is It's Okay Not to Be Okay. Which is a sort of dating column, but really it's about doing things by yourself too, on your own, which is, you know, it's a funny column. It's an emotional column. Smart and funny. I really love that column. And so I was so sad to hear that that Bree had been laid off, as many, many people have, due to this pandemic. She was the social media editor for the Phoenix New Times. And so if you are looking for a social media editor, I highly recommend Bree Malloy. You can find her on Twitter at Bree Malloy. That's BRIMALLOY _ on Twitter. And there are a couple of Skype issues here. I had the call drop in the middle of our conversation. That's something new to get used to. Oh, I can tell you about the internet ordeal. I'll save that for next week's episode, though. But yeah, it was great talking to Bree. And let's go ahead and get into that conversation. How is this whole sequester thing going for you?
It's kind of been going in phases. At first, it was kind of just the usual. I like stay home a lot anyway. And I was like, whatever, this is fun. I get to hang out in my apartment that I pay for. And now I'm completely kind of losing my mind and trying to figure out ways to stay busy. And, you know, I wanted to make bread, but yeast is sold out everywhere because everyone else wants to try to make bread. And like, not unique at all. And so I'm just sitting here thinking about how I want to make bread.
So you have mind bread. well, at least there's less likelihood of it being burnt, or failing. Yeah. Mind bread is always perfect. Except, you know, now I'm thinking about this and I realize that if it were me, just imagine baking, that I would probably still ruin it somehow.
Oh, well, I tried making these cookies a couple days ago and they looked perfect. I was so confident. I took a photo. I was like, I can actually post this on social media. My friends are going to be so proud of me. And I posted a picture like, oh my gosh, these are going in the oven. 15 minutes later, I opened the oven and my dreams were shattered. I don't know what had happened, but they had turned into like brittle. It was crazy. I was like, I wish my reaction was captured on camera, because the gasp that I made, tears were in my eyes. It was a whole ordeal. And my friends were like, how did you do that? Yeah.
That's, I don't know. Baking is something that I can do. It just, anytime you got to follow a recipe, I much prefer just cooking, because it's less of an exact science. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, my friends, they were saying, you know, the reason why you messed up the baking, it's because you're vegan, and vegan stuff is always the worst anyway. And so, you know, the cards were just stacked against me on that one.
I always have to ask this when I find out that somebody's vegan, just because it's similar in my mind to atheism. It's just too much of a commitment for me. So what was your reason behind veganism? Have you always been vegan? Is it something that you worked into from vegetarianism?
Yeah, so whenever I like think back to my childhood and like funny things that I said, I'm like, my parents should have totally just realized I was going to be vegan at some point in my life, because I always was kind of wary of meat and stuff. I mean, I ate it, but whenever I moved out to college and into my first apartment and I had to start cooking for myself, I one realized meat and cheese was expensive, and I never ever wanted to like touch it and cook it myself. Like, my dad always, you know, cooked the meat. So I was just scared of it. And so it was just easier for me to be vegan, in all honesty.
Well,
Later came the ethical stuff.
So see, if I could just, maybe that's the problem. I need to fall into it out of laziness or a distaste for cooking it. That's how anything that involved any sort of bones, I was already out of. So it was pretty easy to give up meat, but cheese is a whole other story. I like dairy too much. I know it's not good for me either, but still, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Cheese was the hardest thing for me to give up, and vegan cheese will never compare. I have this vegan feta and I'm like, whatever you do, you're fine. You do what I want you to do, but you don't taste like it. You don't even feel like it. You just kind of look like it. Good, on the other hand,
it's the mind taste bud connection isn't happening, huh?
No, I mean, you can't recreate feta, I don't think.
I can't imagine. I mean, because already cheese is almost like a science, right? Because it has to, depending on what it is, it ages in some way or whatever. I don't think that you can approximate that with any kind of vegan substitute.
No, but I, you know, yeah. But with the Parmesan that I have, it somehow is super similar to what I remember Parmesan tasting like. So I'm like, whatever. This is, at least they got this stinky cheese right, I guess.
That's good. We can talk about cheese and vegan substitutes as long as you'd like, but, thanks for making the time to do this. It's a weird situation to be in, to, do these interviews over Skype. It's all, you know, kind of new for me, because I always have done these in person with prior to recently only one exception. But it's one of those things about this whole new paradigm shift is that I didn't, you know, I've lived alone for a while now. It's just, you know, me and the cat, and it's, but I had gotten used to somebody stopping by to record, you know, a few times a week sometimes. So not having that interaction is kind of, that's, I think, starting to get to me. You know, cause I didn't care about not seeing anybody at work. Yeah. You know, work was just work, but the, not having that kind of face-to-face intellectual conversation with people is kind of a blow. So yeah, I think I'm kind of in a similar boat here of having initially been like, oh, this is my wheelhouse. I was born to sequester, and now I'm feeling a little stir crazy.
Yeah, I mean, how many Law and Order SVU episodes have you gone through?
for me, it's, I started rewatching Buffy the Vampire Slayer, so I have gone through quite a few of those. But yeah, it's, everybody is binging something, I'm sure now. So for you, it's SVU. What's the appeal of that?
It's just, I think, something I watched in my childhood, and since I stopped, I mean, I've probably seen like all like 10 seasons, and then whenever I went to college, I stopped, and so now I'm kind of insane, and I'm working backwards. Watching them backwards, so I meet in the middle of where I last left off, hopefully.
That's
my insane appeal.
That's a pretty unique way to watch something. I don't think I've ever tried that. I've never gone backwards to catch up with where I left off. Is that the one that alternated teams sometimes? Where, like, 1 week, which one was, no, it's Criminal Intent, right? Where they had, like, a team where it was Vincent D'Onofrio 1 week, and then the next week it was somebody else or something like that. I can't remember.
I don't know. I only watched Criminal Intent a couple of times whenever I was younger, and I was like, this sucks. I just see you. And so I've stuck with it.
I never really got involved with maybe that's a generational difference, but I never got involved with the Law and Order really past Sam Waterston. So it's that was my watch for that show back in I guess late teens or something, but I don't know. But we're not talking about Law and Order either. I had been wanting to talk to you since I started reading the column that you were writing for the New Times, and then a whole bunch of shit happened, which I hope you're okay with talking about. But I want to get to that eventually, since it's kind of the most recent stuff. Were you a journalism major in college? How did you get into writing?
Yeah, so in college I started off with a few different majors before I ultimately switched over to journalism. And just throughout school, I always liked writing and writing essays. I don't know. I definitely loved English more than any other subject. And I didn't really think I would ever be a journalist or even write that column. You know, whenever I got older and did internships and stuff, I really fell into social media. But I guess just writing was always in the back of my mind.
So what, you mentioned that you had kind of played around with some other majors. What were your interests prior to falling into journalism?
I mean, I had gotten into like ASU as marketing, but I'm not an extrovert, so I would fail completely at that. Then I tried communications because I was just kind of lost. I did film for a little bit, but I've never seen Pulp Fiction, so I figured I should get over there. And ultimately, journalism.
Have you seen Pulp Fiction since?
I have not. The only Tarantino film I've seen is the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, it's, you know, that's fine.
Yeah. And that's why I left. That's why I was like, it's not for me, clearly.
You know, there's a point, I think that, I don't know, it was probably years and years of having, hearing one too many times somebody else say, oh, you have to watch this. Oh, you haven't seen this yet? How can you call yourself a film buff and not have seen this, that, or the other thing? Or having music conversations with somebody and have them, you know, ridicule holes in my listening after having, you know, thousands and thousands of hours of film watching and music listening under my belt, that I never try to convince anybody that they have got to see or listen to anything. It's just, it's a futile endeavor. And also, you know, it's the pop culture equivalent of bullying or calling somebody an idiot, which is something that I never saw the point of doing.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that, I mean, I always preferred TV shows over movies. And recently, in the past few months, even all of 2019, I had gone into movie watching a lot more, all thanks to Letterboxd, because I just love like fucking around on there and reading the silly things people have to say. So maybe I'll watch Pulp Fiction to join that conversation, but maybe out of spite, I won't watch it.
See, that sounds like something that I would do. You know, it's anytime somebody was saying, oh, you have to read this or you have to see this, then I just either I did and was sorely disappointed, like Napoleon Dynamite, or I just out of sheer stubbornness was like, well, no, I'm not going to read Harry Potter because everybody's reading it. So, but yeah, you know, it's the more somebody says you got to do something, the more the impulse for me, at least, is to run screaming in the other direction.
Yeah, or to like be weird about it and be like, well, it wasn't that good, and then they're just like, you're just being rude. I'm like, well, you shouldn't have pushed me to watch it.
So had you been kind of writing since you were a kid, or how did you really decide that you wanted to do something in creative arts, for find a way into doing that for a living? Because it's not for somebody who wants to succeed necessarily or make money.
Yeah, I honestly have no clue, because there's kind of like two things. I have never thought of myself as a creative, so it's so weird when my friends are like, but you are being creative. I'm like, I don't know, I'm behind the scenes, like I'm just doing my job, or I'm just doing this. Like, it's not really, I've never seen it as being a quote unquote creative. And then getting into journalism, you know, I knew I wasn't going to make a lot of money, but that's kind of a path you take because, you know, you value informing the community. And I'm sorry if you can hear my cat jumping around. And you just know, you're just doing it kind of out of the good of your heart in a way. That's kind of lame to say, but everyone journalism knows that they're not going to make a lot of money, but they do value just keeping everyone informed. So I don't know. It's kind of those two things. I don't know how they coincide at all.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I think that it's interesting to find your way into something with, all I had wanted to do was something in writing forever, and that's, you know, it seems like the more you intend to do something, the less likely it actually is to happen. And I don't know, that's or I could be have that completely wrong. Maybe I just didn't try hard enough. But I did get into poetry, and if there's anything that is even less likely to have a career path than journalism, it's probably poetry. You know, and then I minored in sociology, so I made sure that I was not having a marketable skill set with a bachelor's degree by the time I got done.
I think that, like, whenever I think of my path to kind of where it led me to do social media work in journalism, newspapers, it kind of stemmed from me trying PR a little bit and just realizing I'm not, like, again, I don't have the energy level for that. And sadly, like, energy level in that industry means a lot. And I'm a quiet, shy, reserved person. But social media and journalism kind of encompassed everything that I liked, which was like entertainment and news and getting to be funny a little bit, writing short little things. And then I ultimately learned about like analytics and data, which I was never like a math person, but in that context, I thought it was really cool. So I think it just encompassed a lot of my interests. And then that led me to that. And somehow everyone says I'm creative. I'm like, wow, this is new for me to accept.
Was it something that you felt ready to accept though? Or is it just, you know, let me take a different tact with this, because I'm curious. So how did you get involved? Let me take another different tact. What was your sort of introduction to social media, and how did you decide that it was something that you could, you know, see yourself using as a marketable skill set?
I guess, you know, being on Twitter since I was young, I really I love social media. Obviously, like every other 24-year-old girl is just like, social media is awesome. And growing up and seeing people like make money off of YouTube and stuff, I mean, I don't have the personality for that or want to do that, but knowing you could, that there's a business side to it, it's not just people joking around, got me really interested in it. Like, to this day, I still keep up on YouTube drama and even TikTok drama now, just because it's something people don't really take as seriously now. I mean, there's a great reporter at the New York Times, Taylor Lorenz, who helps people keep in touch with that, and I value her work a lot. But seeing it from that side as a consumer, I think that's what made me think I'd be good at marketing and wanting to, you know, help market movies and stuff. Why I wanted to major in film was because of that. And then later on in journalism, oh gosh, I'm sorry if you could hear that. Later on in journalism, I thought PR would be the way to go. And I realized that's not, I don't know, it just wasn't it. And then I got a couple internships related to PR where they kind of just had me sitting behind the screen trying to do funny tweets. I remember my first PR internship was with this small company, and they represented a like brain tumor awareness foundation. And my boss at the time said, try to be like Taco Bell on Twitter. And I was like, for a brain tumor awareness foundation, what? Like, that's crazy. I sat there and I was making this content, obviously not funny and disregarding what she was saying because it's not appropriate. But I was like, okay, there has to be more than me just like spitting these, you know, at the time, 140 character tweets. And that's when I kind of felt lost after that internship. Like, okay, the school's not really telling me what I can do with social media, but I know that there's so much you can do, and it's not necessarily PR. And then I landed an internship at the Arizona Republic on the social media team, where I met one of my favorite people ever, Louis Villalobos, who now works at USA Today. But he really opened my eyes as to all that social media could do in regards to news. And that's kind of how I ended up here. And I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. So kind of a lot.
Well, and my goal in this is to not come off as sounding condescending or just like an old person yelling at a cloud. But there's definitely something where I just kind of missed, I guess, what, you know, and I've gotten into it since then. I remember in high school having a MySpace page back when I was considering a career in music, which again would have made even less money than what I was thinking of doing in writing. But you know, so and I still didn't really keep up with that. And then Facebook has always kind of annoyed me, and in the last year, over the last couple of years, I've definitely progressively got off of that to the point where in the last year, I think I can probably count the times on one hand that I will check something in a month. And it's only because I have pages for my various projects. But like Twitter, though, seemed to make sense to me just because of that. Because if I will like think in quips, and so I like to throw that out there. But it's never, you know, as far as actually having some sort of success with a social media presence, that completely eludes me. How do you, you know, what do you see that really kind of works for people, or that people who are doing, let's say people who are making good use of it, not necessarily just for self-promotion necessarily, but actually trying to communicate something of meaning or substance through that? Because I do see it happening, but seeing it in like numbers of somebody who's not just purely a celebrity or social media presence is a little rare.
Yeah, I think that it definitely varies based on platform. And, you know, if you're successful on Instagram, you might not be successful at Twitter or even have a Twitter at all. Facebook, you know, I don't know. Facebook is lame besides Facebook groups, which are people should get into. But, you know, just one of the biggest things was whenever TikTok came out and people wanted newspapers to get on TikTok. And I remember my coworkers or ex-coworkers at Phoenix New Times, they wanted me to like do TikTok kind of jokingly. I'm like, I'm one person, like, you know, you kind of have to know what you're good at. And if you're not good at, you're not going to want to spread yourself thin. And so locally, some of the people that I follow on Instagram that do a really good job, in my opinion, is this new vintage shop that opened called Howdy Arizona. And she's always on there updating on Instagram stories, like the new things that she's gone into her store, takes her audience out with her whenever she's buying stuff for the store. She'll sell stuff through her Instagram stories. So you just can DM her, even if it's in the store. It's super active all the time. She will sometimes, you know, post about her personal life. So you get to know her a little bit. But I think that's, to me, something that I really like. I would consider her a creative in a way, just in that aspect, or small business owner, is that she's always kind of making sure she's keeping you up to date with the stock and all of that. Gracie's does a really great job at showing, you know, the people who go there, all of the music events. I mean, even in this time during coronavirus, they were always, you know, sharing people's stories, tagging Gracie, sharing, you know, the staff, quote unquote, social distancing while they were working. You know, it was always fun. They shared the little cat that's always on their patio. Mm-hmm. They're really great at Instagram. I don't think that would translate onto Twitter. And I don't think either of the two people, Howdy or Gracie's, are on Twitter. If not, I should follow them. But that's kind of where I've seen success on Instagram for some local people that I follow. I obviously don't follow all of them. Then on Twitter, I see, you know, I mostly follow journalists, local journalists. And that's kind of just, I think that people could learn a lot from them. One of my colleagues, Meg O'Connor, she was really great at doing Twitter threads and making sure, you know, she shared background information on stories that she was writing. And I would always encourage that because, you know, whether you're a journalist sharing your story or not, you have a perspective on what you're experiencing. And so I would tell her, you know, there's some things you probably couldn't include in your story, but it's still valid information that you're able to share in a Twitter thread. And that makes it a lot more personal, you know, compared to if someone did it for the Phoenix New Times account or AC Central or whatever. People want to hear the personal details from the person who wrote it, and they're more likely to, you know, follow and engage because they know, hey, this person was out there. And, you know, I always tell people, if you're at a show and you're covering that, you know, tweet a little bit about it, Instagram a little bit about it because people want to see and they want to interact with you while you're there. And, you know, maybe you can share a funny little story that you might not include in your actual draft, but it'll be something that someone could connect to.
So
that was a lot.
That was a lot, but no, it's very interesting. So I'm curious. It certainly seems like to stay relevant in some sort of cultural sense, you have to have some sort of social media presence. And I mean, I've sort of become comfortable with Twitter and Instagram. For the most part, I see Facebook as a dumpster fire. But you mentioned something about Facebook groups and that people should get on there. So I'm curious about that. And then if you can, maybe just, I don't really get what TikTok is. So if you could just maybe enlighten me on that a little bit, I would really appreciate it.
Yeah, I love TikTok. At first I was totally against it. I was like, I'm too old for it. That's stupid. You know, because TikTok didn't start off as TikTok. TikTok started off as this thing called Musical.ly. And there's a lot of like middle schoolers on it just being silly and lip syncing. And I didn't find that creative at all. If you ask my dad thinks lip syncing is very creative. So I don't know. And my dad actually kept pestering me, of all people, to get on TikTok. He's like, it's so funny. You're not giving it the credit that it's due. I'm like, I don't want to see people lip syncing, because I still had that, you know, same mindset that it was Musical.ly. And I finally got on there and I was like, this is hilarious. I mean, there's a lot of trash on there, but there's a lot of trash on the internet. You just know how to sift through it. And so once you figure out how to sift through it, then you find a lot of good content. It's really similar to Vine, if you were ever into that, but just longer. And people are really carefree on there and they share way too much. I mean, it's a lot of teens, some people that are in their 20s, some older people on there. There's like this guy, Vinny, he's clearly a dad and he's always sharing like, here's what I did at work today. And people like love it. They're like, Vinny, you're so positive. And it's so silly. I mean, today I just saw a TikTok of this guy. I don't know how old he was, but he was out on his farm and he's like, I'm going to show you guys the potatoes that I planted. And like, you know, it's potato season. Let's look at them. I was like, this is so wholesome. There's like grandpas on there cooking, but the teens are hilarious and need more credit. They're so funny and dark. And I mean, they're making like jokes about abortion, which maybe we shouldn't be laughing at, but they're hilarious. It's so hard to explain without showing some, but they're great. And of course, you know, there's like the dance challenges that everyone does, but it's fun. It's really, really fun. And I highly suggest you spend like 15 minutes on it tonight.
Okay. I'm feeling
well, Facebook groups.
We'll see about that.
You should.
Okay.
It's so fun.
So Twitter is still a thing. Instagram is still a thing. You know, there's this TikTok. I know I've heard of Vine before. But it seemed like for a while everybody was saying that I had to get on Snapchat, and then I don't really hear anything about Snapchat anymore. So what kind of like, how do things seem to they become the thing for a moment and then they sort of disappear or become less important?
Yeah, so Vine just like ended. The creators of Vine just kind of said, you know what, we're done. Then they tried to come back. I think it was sometime last year with Vine 2.0, but TikTok had already blown up that people were like, you know what, like we do not care at all about Vine 2.0. So that sort of fell off. Snapchat, on the other hand, I mean, to some people's surprise, I do use Snapchat, but just with a couple of friends. And, you know, I've taken so many photos on there that I don't want to delete it and lose the storage that I have, I guess. I wish I wasn't using Snapchat, but that sort of fell off because, you know, Facebook and Instagram, they sort of rearranged how their sites, like their sites, and they included the story feature, which was all that was really unique to Snapchat, was that you can have a story, you can post something for 24 hours and then it would go away. Now Facebook and Instagram have that, and why do you need a third app to do that? That's kind of why that fell off.
Well, and that's something that I was advised to start trying was the stories feature, and I'm just not good at keeping up with that. So what how do people sort of like effectively use that? I guess I've looked at them more since what I'm referring to as the pandemalypse. Because I'll keep following like Stinkweed's Instagram stories because they kept like posting like which new albums they were listing and that sort of thing, which to me that was terribly effective because I was curious what they had since I couldn't go in and actually browse in the store since it was closed. But how is that an effective tool for people?
I mean, it's crazy because it's so open-ended, and it really just depends on what you want to use it for, because there are so many uses. You can, you know, if you're selling something, then you can list it on there, like Stinkweeds and the vintage store that I mentioned do. If you see, or if you're having something come out, you know, like your podcast, for example, you could let people know through there. And it's kind of just almost flood people in a way. And I mean, I've seen people as of recently use the stories to inform, like, I'm into The Bachelor and one of the Bachelor guys got the coronavirus and his girlfriend was documenting it all through Snapchat, you know, saying like day 11, this is how he's feeling. And people really love that because it's short little clips of something really personal. And they care about this person, obviously, so they wanted to know more. Or right now, the Arizona Republic is doing like a really unofficial bracket for the March Madness we didn't have of tacos. They use the poll feature to say like, you know, choose one of these to move on to the next one or whatever. And so that's really effective. It has nothing to do with news, but it's getting the community engaged and their logos on there and everything. So people will be like, oh, did you see that bracket from AZ Central? And so it just kind of depends on what you're trying to showcase, how you want to showcase it, because there's a million different ways. You know, a lot of people like to do questions and answers. And so something you could do, for example, with a podcast is have people, you know, submit questions to ask like a guest if you so want that to happen, or use it for people to recommend someone or suggest someone that you should have on your podcast. And that's kind of getting people engaged without really, you're not even really pushing your content, but they know like, hey, that's out there and I'm kind of contributing it to it in a way. So that's kind of how stories work.
Well, see,
or you just goof around.
Or you just what?
Or you just kind of goof around. Like I walk around and take pictures of like weird things I see in the neighborhood and my friends seem to love it. So
yes, I have enjoyed your pictures of random like furniture fails, like some tub in the yard or something like that. It was pretty funny. So how did you end up getting involved with the New Times, and how did that come about?
Yeah, so while I was working at the Republic, I kind of just felt like I was in a rut. I mean, I loved working there. It was so great. I'm still, you know, two of my best friends work on the social media team over there, and I love them. But I was sort of feeling like I was in a rut, that I needed a challenge. And I wasn't really seriously looking for jobs at the time, but I followed Phoenix New Times on Facebook, and I saw them post that they needed a social media person. I was like, hey, I'm kind of looking for something new. I'll just try it out. You know, I've never worked with anything that needed like an edgy voice. I'm not like a terribly edgy person, so I figured that'd be something good to learn. You know, how to showcase content in a not really PC way. You know, there's a republic, you have to be kind of careful, like, how you frame things. And so it seemed perfect. It was like, I've never, you know, experienced this. And so ultimately I got the job just because I interviewed and I did good, I guess.
I have to credit you actually with, so, you know, I had, you know, made sure to read, articles by contributors that I was friends with and so forth. But, when I talked to, our mutual acquaintance, Jason Kyle, about doing a music column for the New Times, I honestly just went in and wrote something like as though I were writing it for, you know, things that I read growing up and like Rolling Stone or other music periodicals and things that were a little more traditionally journalistic. And then I read the first edition of your column, It's Okay Not to Be Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, fuck, now mine sounds like all super stiff and stuffy and everything. I have to completely rewrite this. And I enjoyed your voice in that so much, and it was so easy to connect with that it just made me, you know, realize that there was absolutely nothing of my personality in the thing that I had submitted. Well, there was some because, you know, I've over at this point, I guess, you know, decades of writing in some, you know, professional capacity or other, I have developed a voice for myself, but it was the professional voice, not the personable voice necessarily, let's say. So, when you were, was this a pitch that you made, or was this something where the New Times was looking for just for more content or more ways to pull in a different sort of readership or whatever? Because, you know, what I'm trying to say is I was a big fan of your column, so I'm trying to get around to how you got to do that.
Yeah, well, first, thank you for reading. I am still, you know, mind blown. I think it's super silly, and people are like, no, it's like, we're cool with it. I'm like, what? Crazy. But I don't even remember when, but sometime in 2019, I just made a silly tweet. Like, I'm clearly like a very awkward person and like, you know, what? Quirky girl, quote unquote. I'm not saying that at all. That's the best way to describe. I made this tweet just joking around, being sarcastic. Like, you know, it would be so funny if I had a dating column because, like, I'm terrible at dating. Like, essentially, because I'm terrible at dating and I miss cues. And I just think it'd be really funny if I did that. But it was just totally a joke, totally me being sarcastic and goofing around. Because I just am like, I'm always hoping people know that I'm being sarcastic online. And it was confirmed to me whenever I first met Jason. He's like, yeah, whenever I met you first, your tweets connected. Like, I totally get it now. I'm like, cool, perfect, thank you. But then he saw that tweet. He was like, no, like, let's do it for real. And I kept pushing it off. I was like, I don't really want to do that. Like, no way. I was just joking. I didn't want anyone to take this seriously. What the heck? Like, I'm just being goofy. And then it just kind of happened. Jason kind of gave me a deadline, and I wrote something, you know, about my experience getting broken up with, because I was broken up with on New Year's Day of 2019. And I figured it'd be kind of fun to go down like how I dealt with it in ways that weren't so sad, and kind of like how I spent the year coming out of being so terribly sad after being blindsided. And then it happened. And then Jason can tell you for sure and vouch for this. I was always in his office, like, please tell me this isn't coming off as, you know, like I'm some higher power and you have to listen to what I'm saying and this is super preachy or whatever. Like, I hope it's like coming off not like that at all. And I was always in his office making sure. And I guess it didn't come off that way. So I'm glad. But I was always nervous about that. So I'm like, who wants to listen to just some girl complain? And that's not how I wanted it to seem at all.
Well, I have to tell you, so it seems like for so long that, you know, that we're socially conditioned to that it's not okay to not be okay. Like you have to like put your at least in social circles and in public and everything that you're you know, just cool with everything and you're fine and all of that. And it's so wrong. It's like you never actually get to process anything that way. You never get to, you know, that you have to allow yourself to not be okay. And then to also be honest about that, because you're not, you know, it's you know, it has to be okay for you to be sad for a while, and it has to be okay for you to realize, you know, or to be able to express that, you know, something really fucking sucks and that you're heartbroken and that you're having maybe some difficulty getting over someone, or you know, that I don't know, it seemed for so long to be like relegated to media, right? To some stupid romantic comedy or something, or some crap like that, that it wasn't the way that people were supposed to be able to behave in real life. And, you know, I mean, sure, there are all sorts of I'm sure schools of therapy and books about out there how, you know, it's important to allow yourself to feel your feelings, but to actually just kind of honestly, you know, like the idea of there being like a good Sprouts parking lot for you to weep in, and that it was very refreshing and something that was like, you know, this is something that I can identify with as even as a late 30s white male. You know, it was something that I could read and be like, oh, you know, I really get this perspective. It's something that speaks to me on a level that I identify with. So anyway, it was something that I really appreciated.
Yeah, well, that like makes me feel so happy to hear, because, you know, I'm totally like a crybaby and sensitive and whatever, but I always felt, I don't know, like whatever, I'll just deal with it at home, like it's fine. Like, but then whenever, you know, I didn't expect to get broken up with, and luckily I had, you know, really great friends and my dad to just kind of let me let loose and cry. Like, I sent my friends so many voice memos of just being like, I'm so sorry, but I just need to get this out. Like, I cannot like handle this on my own. And I mean, nor should you handle a breakup alone, but I've been just so used to, like, I don't like to bother anyone. So I'm like, but you know, now guys, I need to bother you. And, you know, crying at Gracie's and just feeling so relieved that like no one here cares. And it's fine that I'm experiencing this in public. And I mean, if someone cares and they're just rude, I wasn't like outwardly like sobbing, you know, glamorous crying, as one of my friends put it. I was like, wow, it's like a big compliment. When I'm really distressed, I needed to hear that.
One of the reasons, and if you don't want to talk about this, that's fine. But you were recently laid off because of cutbacks that are going really industry wide at this point, and a lot of professions are laying off people, you know, for all supposedly related to this pandemic thing. and which I find some of that a little suspicious, but I get that people can't afford to advertise if they don't have any revenue coming in and all that. So it makes some sense. But journalism already seemed like it was having, or at least relatively traditional journalism was having some real growing pains, as it's honestly surprising that it's taken as long as it has, but in essentially a world that where people just mostly expect information to be free, and don't value it monetarily, there have definitely been some struggles adjusting to it. What you know, did you sort of see some of that coming ahead of this, or how did that, you know, was it this kind of, were you kind of blindsided, or how did that go down exactly?
I mean, my personal getting laid off, I wasn't really expecting it, though I knew, you know, layoffs were imminent. And that's something, you know, we had shared an email we had gotten on our union Twitter. But in general, you know, whenever the coronavirus first kind of kicked off, at least two that I could name, alt weeklies just completely shut down or laid off like a lot of their staff. So we kind of knew, my colleagues and I, that it's bound to happen. But even before that, you know, alt weeklies were kind of suffering, and I hadn't really grasped, you know, the importance of alt weeklies until I worked at Phoenix New Times. But it really is like such a shame, and it's so sad because we're providing such a different voice and, you know, everything that everyone knows. But ultimately, I feel like everyone who's working at an alt-weekly now, or even the ones that recently closed or laid off a ton of people, they did see it coming. And I don't really know what it means for bigger papers like Gannett, because I'm kind of trying to tune all of that out. But, you know, hopefully they can recover. One of my friends at the Republic, she makes above or maybe $38,000, and you know they're furloughing everyone there for a week that makes $38,000 or above at Gannett Papers, and she's kind of like, you know, she's sad about it, but she was telling us that she had been through it before at one of her first jobs, so she's kind of used to it. But the only thing that sucks is if they extend the furloughing out longer than the 3 months that they say. And so I think that's kind of going to be the testament for bigger papers, is, you know, after coronavirus settles — is a terrible word, not the right word I want to use — but after that settles, you know, however they begin to adapt or evolve, like, that's going to really show. Because obviously right now it's kind of like sink or swim for any paper. And however they're handling it, whether, like, you know, you think it's wrong or right, it's kind of like crisis situation mode. You got to do it. But I don't know. I think it's kind of just seeing what happens afterwards, after this virus is over.
Have you kind of had time to think about how, like, what you're looking to do and what you would like to do in the future?
Yeah, I mean, my goal has always been, or has evolved to be, more behind the scenes and looking at, you know, audience analytics and data to help make more informed decisions as to, like, how to post on social media, who our audience is, and more so on the back end to assist and leverage, you know, reporting and coverage. And I think that's really important. Something I wish I could have done more at New Times, but at New Times you kind of have to wear a lot of hats, and so I wasn't able to go as deep as I was able to at the Republic. But I have looked at more like audience analytics jobs, and I do like this kind of work a lot because it is important to, I don't know, framing your messaging is so cool. I would always tell the interns whenever I came across them at the Republic at New Times, like, this is the coolest job to have, and I cannot believe I'm allowed to even have it or have had it, because you're in charge of how things are seen, and you can word things how you think, you know, someone will click on it or how they'll be the most informed on any platform. And that's so important, and you need to take a lot of care with it, you know, especially with people, you know, spouting fake news every 2 seconds. And it's just the most important job. And I don't think everyone can do it. I mean, you can do it if you don't care, and it'll be obvious that you don't care. And it'll be seen. Like, okay, this person, you know, there's this social media site sucks, their Twitter sucks. And you'll think, okay, well, why is that? And it's, you know, the person behind the screen probably, you know, was thrown into doing social media, or they thought that they knew what social media was about, and they're still, you know, learning. And so, I don't know. It's just such an important job that people haven't seemed to grasp or don't know how to kind of mold it, because it is so new, you know, like, this kind of job in journalism and in general is so new and really underutilized. And I think at times, like, taken for granted, social media teams, because I don't know who, we're in charge of your content, the people who, you know, are posting on Twitter, and you should really be giving those people resources and help and take them seriously, because we're not just, you know, hitting send on Twitter at all. Like, that's not what it is. So I still want to do this kind of work, if it's, you know, in journalism for Kim Kardashian, I don't know, ghostwriting her tweets. Do it, you know.
That would be an interesting career move.
Yeah, it would be fun.
So have you thought about maybe, you know, continuing the column on your own, starting up a blog or anything like that? Or is that something that's even really a thing that people look for anymore?
Well, the popular thing now is newsletters. Like, before it was like everyone has a podcast. Now it's everyone has a newsletter. Hmm. Like, well, I don't want to be that person, so I have no idea. Everyone was asking me, like, you should continue it. I'm like, I don't even know where to start, because I didn't even, like, I just was being silly and fun. And obviously I need to be edited. I don't have perfect grammar, like, or whatever. So I'm like, I have no idea where to start at all. But it would be cool. I have a lot more to say, because I love to talk about myself. And like, be funny at people's expense, like at my own expense, for other people's enjoyment.
Well, so. I hope you'll continue on with that. It's definitely something that I looked forward to reading. So it would be nice to see that land somewhere. I did have one other thing, because, you know, actually there were a couple of things, and then we'll wrap up. And now, especially because for a lot of artists and musicians and people who work in creative fields and have historically, you know, made their living off of being in front of other people or with other people in gatherings, and are now, for basically the foreseeable future, out of that, you know, unable to make their connections and make their living that way. What would your advice to them be on an effective way to utilize social media to put their work out there?
Yeah. I was kind of thinking about this a little bit, and I think something that everyone's utilizing right now, and it's not, you know, unique at all that I'm saying it, but is the Instagram Live feature. I attended, I guess you could say, Pitchfork's live stream with Wise Blood and watched her perform like, I don't know, 6 or 8 songs. And immediately after, I was like, well, I need to stream this album and cry again because I love her so much. But I think that people, you know, musicians could ask to partner with maybe Zia Records or Stinkweeds and do kind of an Instagram Live collab concert like Pitchfork's doing with a ton of people. And that's still kind of getting them out front. I mean, Wise Blood was just acoustic, or she had her like keyboard. It wasn't like a big elaborate production at all. It was super intimate. And there was like 3,000 people watching or 4,000 people watching. And she was reading some comments too, so it was really engaging. But I think that's one way that musicians could, and I'm sure, I mean, I don't know, I don't work for a record store or anything like that, but I'm sure that if that's not already in the works, that they would like to do that. And I think, you know, artists could do a live painting thing. I know people do that, or just talk on Instagram Live, because everyone's at home bored, and you know, you might as well just film yourself painting for like 30 minutes or graphic design. I watched some girl, I have no interest at all in like Photoshop or whatever, and this girl's Instagram story must have been like 50 taps long, and I just sat there and watched all of it. And I was like, well, her art's good, you know, let me follow her, I guess. I don't know. It was just, people are going to be watching anything. And it was just honestly soothing to watch her do different brush strokes. So anyway, I think Instagram Live should be utilized a ton, not just by randos that just want to rant, but by people actually showcasing their talents. And even Facebook Live, you know, if you start getting traction and people are watching, they're sharing with their family, and you know, the views are going to rank up on there. But I think doing that, having people ask you questions, giving people advice, even you can promote yourself, like kind of like I mentioned before, without really even promoting yourself. So a big thing is like Instagram questionnaire templates. If you are, you know, the Van Buren was sharing one a couple days ago that was saying, you know, what, who was your favorite band to see live? And not necessarily at the Van Buren, just like anywhere. Mm. What was your favorite show at the Van Buren specifically? What's your favorite venue ever? What's your whatever, whatever, whatever. And you could tag the people. And so people are sharing that. So whenever the Van Buren got tagged, they would share that onto their story. Whenever a band got tagged, they would share that onto their story. So it's still, you're still promoting yourself. I mean, you have to make sure you like put your little symbol at the bottom of those Instagram questionnaires. But, you know, you're still promoting yourself and not even doing any work. You're letting your audience do the work. I mean, don't tell them that. But people are sharing stuff and they want to, you know, it's like those MySpace quizzes. People like to talk about themselves, their experiences, and share it with their friends and tag their friends. And I think that's the biggest thing. If you can create something that people can interact with and share with right now, or share with their friends, like, you know, that's the biggest thing. And then ultimately they're going to be like, okay, well, who created this? Oh, it was so-and-so. Let me go check out their profile, because I've done that several times. Everyone's done that several times. You know, Twitter is a little bit more difficult, but you can still do polls and whatever on there. But I think just, you know, showing that you're still here, you're not dormant, you're not whatever, could be, it's just a great way to show that you're still there. I don't know. I'm just talking in circles now.
No, that was great. I think that's a great way to wrap up. And I really appreciate you taking the time and chatting with me. For whatever it's worth, it would be nice to see more of your writing, because it was pretty great. So, that's it. I hope you are doing well and staying safe in all of this, and enjoying all that quality time with your cat.
Thank you. You too. This is like seriously so fun. I feel like a huge star. And I can't wait to be embarrassed whenever my dad listens and is like, oh my God, you should speak better. I'm
like, oh. Well, yeah, this was great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, that's it. That's the show. Thanks as always for listening. And thanks again to my guest, Bree. And yeah, hope you're all doing well. Stay safe, stay distant, stay at home, wash your hands, all that stuff. And see you on down the road. This has been a Hoon Waddle production. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not check out one of our other fine podcasts available from hootandwaddle.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or any number of podcast apps. If you'd like to support Hoot and Waddle and get access to an exclusive member-only podcast, receive discounts on merch, and more, go to patreon.com/hootandwaddle.